Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Light on the Dark Ages, Bristol's very own Tony Dyer in his book on Anglo-Saxon democracy, published in 2010. And you'll find Wessex was at the centre of events. Then Charles Shee. He's a whistleblower that used to work for a company called NHJ, manufacturing parts for Boeing aircraft. They turn out to be fake parts through a company called Moog, marketed to Boeing and people repairing Boeings for the Boeing 737 and the Boeing 737 MAX, the infamous aircraft involved in two crashes, which has now been grounded. But he was warning 2 years ago about safety issues and fake parts on these aircraft. We hear a clip from him talking in Shanghai, China, about corruption within the Chinese police failing to investigate evidence that Boeing were accepting fake parts knowingly. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name is Tony Dyer. I'm born and bred Bristolian, and I've been involved in politics for a while, but that's not why I'm here today. One of the other things I've always been interested in and written about is history, in particular Anglo-Saxon history, and also local and familiar history. But Anglo-Saxon history is a topic that I'm very interested in, largely because it tends to be neglected.
Well, yeah, isn't it the Dark Ages?
Yeah, that was the terminology it was used. It's very much frowned upon nowadays. And it's misleading because we do have a tremendous amount of information about the so-called Dark Ages, and particularly as we go into the later period of Anglo-Saxon. But even right from the beginning, there are plenty of evidence, both archaeological and also written evidence. It's just that some of it, or a lot of it, tends to have been ignored in the past.
So is that out of convenience? Do you think people were just thinking, well, actually, we would rather just skip over this? And, you know, is there any reasons why you think that there wasn't a proper engagement by historians?
I think twofold is a lot of it, historians, particularly into recently, tended to see themselves very separate from archaeologists. So they tended to rely on the written word. And for the early part of Anglo-Saxon history, the Anglo-Saxons were essentially illiterate, so there's not so many written records. Where those written records do exist, they tend to be on the Celtic side, if you like, in Wales and Old Wales, and they tended to be, English-speaking historians tend to look down on the Welsh sources and not use them as much.
Well, look, let me try and place the Anglo-Saxon period, and do correct me if I'm wrong here. So we had a whole load of Iron Age hill forts, didn't we, before the Romans turned up. The Romans basically overran all those hill forts in whatever, around about 40, 50 AD, and they stayed for about until about 500, am I right? And that's when the Anglo-Saxon period officially sort of starts. Am I roughly right there?
You're roughly right. I mean, I think what we tend to do is we tend to look for easy dates to say this is when something ended and when something began. So what is normally seen is the Roman period is usually seen as the period from when the Romans invaded in AD 43 up until AD 410, which is supposedly when there was a letter sent by the Roman emperor to say, you're on your own, we can't do anything to help you anymore. And that's usually seen as the start of the Anglo-Saxon period.
Okay, so what happened? Did the Roman legions all withdraw from Britain, disband or what?
Well, and this is kind of going back to having absolute dates, is that the legions had been withdrawn quite a while before. What had happened was that Britain had become the place where Roman emperors had started to be proclaimed by the soldiers. I mean, what happened with the decline of the Roman Empire is often wherever there was an army, they decided they had enough of the present emperor, and they would then choose a leader from amongst their own group and say, this is the new emperor. And then obviously that emperor would leave Britain and go and try and conquer the west of the Roman Empire, taking his troops with him.
So looking back at Rome, what was it really that sort of led to the end of it? Or what was it? Was it just that there was not enough checks and balances on Roman power? I suppose that's how we think of it. I mean, you think of things like films like Caligula and, you know, that sort of thing where they can just do what they want and there's no checks.
There was a certain element of that, but it's more a financial crash. Basically, the way the Roman system started work, people in certain areas who were wealthy didn't pay taxes. The people who did all the work got fed up doing all the work, and at the same time, there was population pressures from outside. The Roman Empire was them needed more soldiers, and often because there wasn't enough of a population of Roman citizens itself, and many of them didn't want to be. Now, in the front line fighting.
Well, I can imagine, actually, if you were an Italian Roman soldier, one of the last places in the world you want to be posted up is up to Hadrian's Wall with the terrible weather and the awful winters and just having rocks and spears and things thrown at you.
This is true, and although, to be fair, for quite a long period, Italians had long ceased to be at the core of the Roman army. If anything, it was Spanish or North African troops tended to be, and Greeks as well. And quite an early, quite a long time before the official end of the Roman period, you would have had what we now refer to as Angles and Saxons and Frisians in England, because they were brought in to be the troops that were guarding possibly Adrian's frontier, but also defending the southern shore of England against their own kind coming from over the North Sea, who wanted to get into the Roman Empire.
How does Wales fit in? We're obviously quite close to Wales here. Were the Welsh all subdued by the Romans too?
The Welsh were never truly subdued. I mean, the reality is the Romans really, Roman influences tend to be limited to the southeast of Britain. So you'd be looking at areas around London, around Cirencester, down towards the Mendips. So those areas tended to be Romanized. But even then, it tended to be an urban domination. Out in the country, there was much less Romanization. So people probably carried on speaking whatever language they were speaking at the time. In fact, that's where we get the terminology pagans from, because the Roman territories were divided up, first of all, into civitates, which were large areas. So the one that covered our area covered Gloucestershire.
Like regions, basically.
Yeah. Think of it as regional government. And then below that, they were divided up into what we might call counties, but they were called pagi or pagi. And they were seen as barbarians. The people in the countryside were the pagans. Urban people were the Christians.
Okay, so we see the period after the Roman occupation as the Anglo-Saxon period. Who were the Angles? Who were the Saxons?
Okay, well, in general, they were a host of people, usually speaking Germanic languages, and mostly coming from what is now Denmark and northern Germany. Some came from further afield.
Hang on, that's interesting, isn't it? Because Saxony is not northern Germany. You know, you think of surely the Saxons are supposed to come from Saxony, but they don't.
Well, they did at the time. I mean, what you had is large population movements. Saxony was originally the area of Saxons, but the Germanic peoples were facing expansion from the Slavs, and the Slavic people were caused by tribes further to the east, like the Huns and so on, expanding into their territories. So there was a lot of people under pressure looking for somewhere better to live where they themselves would be safe.
So when can we say the Anglo-Saxon period starts then?
Depends what part of the country you're talking about. You probably can start talking about the Anglo-Saxon period beginning in the east. So in East Anglia, Kent, London area, quite early on, probably the 5th century and onwards.
So pretty much straight after the Romans.
Almost straight after. But for our part of the country, Somerset, well, Gloucestershire and Somerset, Wiltshire, you're talking much later. Wiltshire would have been 6th century or so on. The first indications we have, putting King Arthur to one side for the moment, I'm sure that'll come up in a moment, but most people represent the Battle of Durham in AD 577 as being the period when the Saxons took over our part of the country, down to the River Avon, and then south of the river where I'm from, still stayed Celtic.
Okay, so they were Celts they were fighting. I mean, is this... I think, that, you know, we generally think of the Celts as being having their own language, retaining their own language, being the Irish, the Welsh, the Gaelic languages, the Cornish language.
Yeah, I think Celts is a different... You know, is a controversial term to use, and it upsets a lot of people. I mean, there's the idea of that there are languages that are referred to as being Celtic nowadays. Whether that actually has any direct link with the Celtic culture that existed in Europe prior to the Roman expansion is up for debate. But what we had is probably the best way to describe them is Welsh as a language didn't exist, Cornish didn't exist. We had a Welsh series of British people, Britons, as opposed to Anglo-Saxons who spoke different languages or different dialects, but usually it's assumed that they spoke of a version of languages that then later became Welsh and Cornish and Cumbric and so on.
But you're using the word Britain there. I mean, surely this is, you know, this is not just Wales, England. There's already some understanding of this being one country rather than, you know, an amalgamation of lots of different. Where does the word come from, do you know?
Well, Britain. It's usually, it turns up quite early on in Roman circles and before that in Greek and even Phoenician circles. There's a reference to the Prytanic Isles with a P as being a major, you know, these mystical islands that were on the edge of the world and were very important because when the Bronze Age came along, copper was easier to find. But to create bronze, you needed tin. And there was only very few places that actually produced tin. One of those is Cornwall and West Devon. And that's where the Prytanic Isles suddenly became a focus of attention because it had these natural resources.
Wow, it goes back a long, long way.
Long, long time.
Okay, so how do we get to the stage where we've got the various Anglo-Saxon kingdoms like Northumbria, Mercia, Wessex, that sort of thing?
Well, that's a story in itself. What happened over a period of time was you had different groups. And I think it's important to make the point that usually we assume that it was the Angles and the Saxons on one side and the Britons, you know, the Celts, whatever you like to call them, on the other side. It was almost certainly much more complicated than that. So you often have different Angle groups attacking different Saxon groups attacking other Saxon groups. And you also had the different Proto-Welsh and Proto-Cornish, they were still, didn't see themselves necessarily as one kingdom. In fact, there has almost never been a period when Wales was united until after it became dominated by the English.
At what point, I mean, because I'm imagining all these various factions raiding each other from time to time, but then you've got the Vikings too turning up.
The Vikings turned up in the 8th to 9th centuries. So by that time, your point earlier is valid. By that time, the Angles and Saxons and Frisians and Jutes and so on had coalesced into what was known as the Heptarchy, which is seven separate kingdoms, of which the three main ones were Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex.
It does seem as if almost every time we manage to sort things out here in the British Isles that someone comes along and causes a load of trouble. In this case, it was the Vikings. But anyway, the Heptarchy, how did that come about? And how did it work? Because obviously, if you're going to actually not be fighting each other, you need to have, even though you've got seven different kingdoms, they need to have some sort of agreement.
Well, what tended to happen is you have alliances built up, and then depending often on who the leader was of a particular kingdom at the time, one of the states would become more powerful than the others. And he started to get recognition of somebody who was the overall ruler, or known as the Bretwalder. And then they were seen as being the primary king. That doesn't, which tended to mean that the other states, the other Anglo-Saxon states, would tend to do homage for them.
So what were the seven Anglo-Saxon states?
The seven Anglo-Saxon states were Northumbria, Mercia, Wessex, Essex, Kent, East Anglia, Essex, and one I've forgotten.
Okay. But so the Scotland's not included in this?
No, although Scotland did have an Anglo-Saxon kingdom of its own, which was Deira or Bernicia. The Anglo-Saxons have long been part of Scottish history and have been a major part of Scotland.
And Bristol, were we sandwiched between Mercia and Wessex? Or
we would have... We don't really know when Bristol started and was created as a place, but where we are, where Bristol is now, it was on the border with the River Avon, almost certainly being the border between Mercia on the north of the river and Wessex on the south of the river. So essentially when Gloucestershire and Somerset, that border basically carried on from Mercia and Wessex.
So with these seven kingdoms, when did they coalesce and start to be organised as that, rather than, you know, a bunch of warring factions?
Well, we can really thank the Vikings for that. It was the Vikings that kind of created, if you like, an existential threat to the Anglo-Saxons, and in the end forced them to unite in order to face down Orfeu. What really happened was the Vikings came in. They had new fighting techniques. They had freedom of movement. They could land anywhere they wanted. And also, they were able to come here and attack farms. So most of the victories that the Vikings had were actually over local people. So you had essentially professional warriors against the local militia, which is why the Vikings found it so easy to win many battles.
Did we have fleets of our own, or we just had
nothing? Not so much later, because there was never felt to be a need for them. We had trading ports that were trading overseas. Southampton was one of the earliest ones. So there was a training, but there was never felt to be a need to have a proper navy of any sort.
I mean, I'm surprised Bristol wasn't a trading port, because it is a kind of natural harbour, isn't it? And you've got the natural defences of the gorge here. It's quite perfect, really.
Yes, it would have been. It's difficult to know when Bristol... I mean, Bristol isn't really mentioned as a place name into the 11th century. It suddenly appears fully formed with a mint and so on. So it almost certainly existed before then. There is also some kind of circumstantial evidence to suggest that Bristol may have existed when the Vikings were around. And the reason why that is in Bristol, unlike almost everywhere else, the key sites are referred to as backs, and there's a guy who's done some looked at this and looked at the potential origin of the word, and the only origin you can find is a Norse word, which turns up in Icelandic literature and also in Norway as well, where backing means essentially a key. So, and if you follow a route from Bristol to Ireland, which was a big, and to Dublin and the Irish slave ports, nearly all the navigation points actually have a Norse origin. So wherever Bristol became a place, it almost seems certain that Bristolians were taught to sail to Ireland, which has always been Bristol's major trading port, by the Vikings.
Wow. What about faith and religion? Because, you know, I would imagine with the Vikings being sort of quite fanatical in their, I think, Norse mythology and all that stuff, that may have had an influence. So had Christianity taken a hold on Britain at that point, or what?
By that point, Christianity had always, essentially, Roman Britain was a Christian, at least in the urban areas, it was a Christian province. And the Welsh were Christian. The Britons were Christian and stayed Christian all the way through it. The Anglo-Saxons came in with the same sort of mythology as the Vikings later came with. So you have Woden and Odin and Thor, and there are alternatives. It's just essentially the same religion. So when the Vikings came in later, after the Anglo-Saxons had Christianized, it was almost like poacher turned gamekeeper to a sense, because it was the same type of warlike religion that drove the Anglo-Saxons 100 years before. when the Anglo-Saxons became Christianized, again, it depends on which part of the country. As a whole, the Pope sent over a mission in the beginning of the 7th century to convert the Anglo-Saxons, and it set up a diocese based in Canterbury, and then later another one was set up in York. Our part of the country was almost certainly already Christian. In fact, there was a strong possibility that our part of the country had quite a mixed Christian, whereas English, Saxon.
Glastonbury and Shaftesbury are both pretty early Christian settlements.
Shaftesbury became the first cathedral set up in Wessex was at Winchester, and then Shaftesbury was later set up after the Saxons conquered Devon, Somerset and Devon, and they then set up a religious centre at Shaftesbury in Dorset.
Okay, so what about the sort of denouement between the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms and the Vikings? Because I would imagine at some point the Anglo-Saxons said, right, well, we've had enough of this, let's really get organised.
Yeah, the person we have to thank most for that is King Alfred. And basically King Alfred managed to essentially militarised the entire country. A lot of people talk about Prussia and the German state of Prussia, about how militaristic that was, with what proportion of the population was involved in the army. That was nothing compared to...
Sounds like
to
Sparta or something.
Well, yeah, same. I mean, Anglo-Saxon England under Alfred, and Wessex in particular, was on a par with Sparta and Prussia. Everything was militarised. Every single man... and in some cases, male children as well, had to give up time to go and serve in the local forces. And he also set up a standing army, and he set up a navy as well. And the system he came up with, he built a series of forts or burhs, essentially around the borders of Wessex and its allied Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
Which were what?
Burhs were essentially forts.
No, I mean which kingdoms were part of this burh system?
But by that time, the Vikings had completely taken over Northumbria, and they had pretty much conquered Mercia and East Anglia and Essex. So what was left was Wessex, which at that point essentially consisted of the land from Devon, Somerset, Dorset, Berkshire, Wiltshire, Hampshire, the Iowa, and then also allied with that were, and by this time no longer really functioning as independent countries, were Sussex, Kent, and Surrey.
Okay, so these burhs, what were they?
They were essentially forts. They were forts. In many places, they were built large enough to shelter the local population. And then they were also given access to what was called a total number of ides of land. And each ide of land was enough land to be able to provide two people to protect the fort. And I say the reason why it was two people was because they did 6 months each and then swap over. So basically the idea was there would be one person in the fort and one person harvesting the crops and looking after the cattle.
So hang on, one person in a fort can't do much, can they?
No, one person for every hide of land.
Oh, right.
So if you look at Bath, for instance, which was one of the burhs, Bath had 1,000 hides of land, so that provided 1,000 men to man the walls at each time. And then the length of the wall was calculated to be enough to be covered by 1,000 men. And by today's standards, we tend to think of 1,000 men has not been very many. But you have to remember that in Anglo-Saxon terminology, an army was anything more than 13 men. I mean, the armies were quite small. The great heathen army, which was seen as being this massive army, was only a few hundred men.
Amazing. Did you think Alfred was borrowing some of his ideas from the Roman forts, maybe ruins of Roman forts, or where did he get his ideas from, do you think?
I think there was a number of sources for his ideas. One of them was an early Anglo-Saxon Mercian king called Offa. But also, he took ideas from across the channel. Because one of the things the Vikings had obviously done was they turn up in their launch ships and they sail up the river. So, for instance, we know that they sailed up the River Avon and then along the Trim and set fire to Westbury Church, or what was then before was Westbury Church. So what they started to do was, as part of the Boers, was they put the Boers in positions where they had fortified bridges to actually stop the Vikings being able to sail up the river. And there is an argument that that's possibly maybe where Bristol started, was maybe they decided that Bath, because Bath was in Wessex, Alfred later took over control of Mercia through his children. That gave him access to Bristol. So maybe then decided that it'd be better to move the Burr from Bath up to Bristol. And that, maybe that's how Bristol got started.
Yeah, bring the fight to the Vikings. Well done, Alfred. You can understand it. How come he ended up out in the middle of nowhere in the levels then, burning cakes?
Because initially he was defeated. Essentially, he came very close to losing. If it had gone a slightly different way, he had been defeated by the Vikings. He lost quite a few battles. It took him a while to learn how to fight the Vikings at their own game. And essentially, he was driven with just the remnants of his army into the marshes. And at the marsh, basically, marshes sound like quite a nice term, or the marshes. Essentially, think of swamps. I mean, basically, the whole of Somerset Levers, you could go in there and never come out again. You could lose entire caravans of goods in the marshes. Basically, he was able to get there, and then he was able to get support, round up men, and then they came out ready to fight, and then they started a series of battles, which then brought the Vikings. It was a Viking. They fought a battle near Chippenham, and they eventually defeated the Vikings of that time. The Vikings agreed to convert to Christianity. And then what Alfred did, which people sometimes forget, he then agreed to allow the Danes to stay in the lands, most of the lands that they had conquered, which was East Anglia, and also what is now the East Midlands. And a line was drawn essentially down the middle of England, down the middle of the Pennines, across to Essex. On the west side, English law ruled. On the eastern side, Danish law.
The Dane law.
So you had the Dane law. I mean, that's also where we got some of the East Midland towns like Leicester and Nottingham and so on.
So, at this point, surely this whole idea of having seven kingdoms and having one, was it Brett Wilder? You said he was the chief king of those seven kingdoms. That must have broken down
to all extent and purposes.
Especially if Mercia has been pretty much, laid waste by the Vikings.
After that point in time, Mercia, for instance, only existed as a separate nation in name only. And only a couple of generations later, Alfred's grandson essentially just told the ruler of the Mercia at the time, you're no longer a king, you're now an Ur. And after that, it became Urdom. So you had the Urdoms of Mercia and the Urdom of Northumbria and the Urdom of Wessex. And essentially, it was
so he demoted them in the feudal system, right?
Yeah, because of the impact of the Vikings, they had ceased to be independent countries. They were no longer, they were dominated by the Danes. They were no longer able to protect themselves. And all his descendants did is make de facto what was already de jure. He made it official what was already happening in practice, which was that Wessex was now England had essentially, Wessex had essentially conquered the west of England.
Okay, so this battle in Chippenham, when was it? And was that it? Was that the Vikings subdued and did they behave themselves?
No, in fact, well, for a while it maintained the peace.
What year are we talking about?
We're talking about the late 9th century. So we're talking about coming into the 10th century. So we're talking about coming into a period where we're now more familiar with written history and so on. I've forgotten the exact date of the battle. I think it was 878 or something like that. But over that period of time, Alfred was late 9th century. after Alfred, essentially we now, he's essentially seen as the founder of England as a country, although in reality it was only later under Athelstan that we actually saw England officially become a country on its own.
I mean, he was called the Great for all sorts of reasons, but one of the things he did was set up things like learning and libraries and that sort of thing, which is obviously quite important. I mean, we've had this battle in Bristol here over the libraries over the last few years, with the mayor amazingly claiming that he saved the libraries. I mean, we don't want to get too much into local politics, but anyway, he was quite into libraries, wasn't he, Alfred?
Alfred was, I mean, he's the only ruler of anywhere in the British Isles that has been given the epitaph, the Great. None of the others have been, you know, Elizabeth or whatever. None of them have been called the Great. It's only Alfred. And you're right, it's not just because he essentially saved the ideal of England, and I say the ideal of England, but also because of the stuff, the work he did in spreading literature, spreading learning. As a child, he made a pilgrimage to Rome. He was very religious. He helped set up and enable the church system, but also at that time, the church wasn't just about religion as we see it now. It was a whole series of things about setting a moral idea of how people should behave. And also, he had the idea, he could have, a lesser king might have said, well, I've beaten the Vikings, I'm going to go on fighting them. Instead, he came to terms with them, and that took courage to do that. By coming to terms with the Danes, he actually turned the Danes in England into his allies. Having said that,
I said, did they behave themselves? And you said no.
Well, there was always some conflict between the original Anglo-Saxon way of doing things and the Danish way of doing things. The Danes certainly had a lot more independence within their own territory than the equivalent English nobles did in their side. So there was always a sort of level of independence. But also, one of the problems we were saying about Alfred having created England is that later on, the Danes actually conquered England. We had Canute and Sweyn Fortebjerg actually conquered England and became kings of England. In fact, Canute set up a kingdom that covered from England, included parts of Ireland, Norway, Denmark. He created a great North Sea empire. And it was only into William the Conqueror, who himself was descended from the Vikings, who came along, and then we became a Norman state.
What about Arthur? Isn't he supposed to have been Anglo-Saxon? Did he ever really exist? Or was he sort of... this is a bit of a dispute about this, isn't there, as to whether he was a sort of creation of the Abbot of Glastonbury in order to try and get people to come down and do pilgrimages and that sort of thing. What's the evidence for Arthur?
Well, there was definitely an historical person called Arthur, whether it's the same Arthur that we hear so much about. But there are... written histories that were quite close to the time of the period, which talk about Arthur in a way which implies that he was an historical figure. Where he was and whether there was more than one famous warrior called Arthur and whether he was a king is open up to debate, and we may never ever know the truth. My gut feeling is that there was somebody called Arthur who fought right at the beginning, fought some major battles against the invading Anglo-Saxons and probably stopped our part of the country in particular from falling into what happened in the east of England, where it became very Anglo-Saxon dominated.
I mean, your book is called Anglo-Saxon Democracy, but was it really democratic? Did it, you know, was it just a monarchy, or, you know, do you think that there was a real kind of expression of the people's will through people like Alfred, or was it just as much as we could have expected at the time?
I think it was within the circumstances of the time. I mean, let's not sugarcoat it. I mean, it was, you had slavery, women had almost no rights whatsoever. And even within those people who were seen as free, how much you were worth depending on your status in life. And you
this
can
is
get
the feudal
that.
System, isn't it? I mean, there's, I suppose, you know, unless you're right at the top of that feudal tree, you kind of got to behave yourself.
I think what and the reason why I wrote the book about Anglo-Saxon democracy was there was elements within the Anglo-Saxon period which, all through by today's standards, we think, oh, that's not democracy. But then you compare it to what happened after the Normans arrived, and you can see there was a lot more ability to have your say in what was happening. I mean, obviously, you know, you can decide what the country's foreign policy was going to be, but at a local level...
Yeah, stop the Vikings.
Please stop the Vikings.
Yes, that was quite a popular
We want
one.
Vets it. But at a local level, what you had in Anglo-Saxon times is you had what was called a tithe, which was... Well, there was a tithe in had different meanings at different times. It's also one-tenth of what you produce had to go to the church, but there was also a group of 10 who made decisions about what happened in the local area. And then 10 of those groups would then create something called a 100, which would cover quite a wide area, and they would send representatives then to what became known as a shire moot, which would make decisions about the entire county, what we would call a county now, or a shire in those days. And they would have influence. I mean, they wouldn't be able to get away with saying whatever they wanted, but they could have some influence over the decisions that were made.
What about Anglo-Saxon basic things like health, education? Was there much?
There was a form of education, but the Anglo-Saxons until Alfred, it started to change over Alfred, but before Alfred, the Anglo-Saxons weren't especially renowned for book learning, but they did like stories. And you know, some of the great works of literature, you know, we have Beowulf, all through it's to do with things that happened in Scandinavia. It's essentially an English piece of work.
And so was it mostly oral history then?
History,
so
mythology.
Oral rather than written? Or
yeah, in most cases, it would have been oral. It would have been, to be fair, I mean, a lot of people, you know, you study Greek history and say about Homer's Odyssey, and they forget that was oral for almost 1,000 years. Homer's Odyssey was basically just, the Odyssey was just a story that was written down, and it was only much later that Homer came along and said, oh, I'll write this down. And now everybody says, oh, Homer is a great writer. But it wasn't. He was just basically rewriting something that had been written a long time before.
I mean, what about things like basic life expectancy, the sort of things we would hope for today? You know, any ideas about, you know, what life was actually like in Anglo-Saxon times for ordinary folk?
Obviously... No, we've had great medical advances and so on. Anglo-Saxon, when the Vikings weren't burning down your village, Anglo-Saxon life, yeah, it was hard, it was brutal. You worked long hours, but at the same time, the water was safe to drink. Much later on, in medieval time, quite early, you would never drink the water. Everybody was drinking alcohol. I mean, basically, you drank beer because the water wasn't safe. And in Viking times, it deteriorated. But when we talk about the Viking period, and it's seen as this period of pillage and rape and so on, it's quite infrequent over the period of times. It's not like batters nowadays. You had long periods where life just carried on as normal.
I mean, around this area, are there any Anglo-Saxon remains much? There are a few Saxon churches and things, aren't there, dotted around?
There's churches with Anglo-Saxon origins. Probably, if you look at churches in the Bristol area, probably the church with the longest history I've always been in within Bristol is St. Peter's Church in Castle Park. But that's not the oldest church in what is now Bristol. You'll probably have to go up to Westbury, as mentioned, long before a church in Bristol is mentioned. And St. John's in Bedminster, which unfortunately there's nothing to be seen of it above ground. As a history, it dates back to well into the 8th century.
What about towns locally?
The Anglo-Saxons really didn't like towns. So what tend to happen is, if you look at the Roman towns that we know existed, they almost all went into decline because there wasn't the infrastructure set up, particularly in the early Anglo-Saxon period, to support people living in a town. It was essentially an agriculture, holding.
Yeah, you'd have to have someone bringing food in and that sort of thing, wouldn't you?
And also you have to have a reason. You didn't have a monetary system or anything like that. There was no need for that sort of stuff until later on. But if you were looking at Anglo-Saxon town, probably the best example of Anglo-Saxon towns would be, if you look at Somerset, for instance, there are a number of towns which were known as warrior towns. They were basically the original warrior places that the king would go and visit when he came to Somerset, look around the Somerset area. And one of them, strange enough, is Bedminster, but unfortunately there's nothing Anglo-Saxon left in Bedminster. But you can go to places like Cheddar, Axbridge, Wales in Somerset is another example of the Anglo-Saxon features down there.
When the Normans turned up, all this came to an end. I mean, legitimate, do you think, all the criticism of the Normans? There's been a lot of criticism, hasn't there, of the Doomsday Book and that sort of thing. What was that like, do you think, when the Normans arrived?
Oh, I think if you were one of the Anglo-Saxon nobles or an Anglo-Saxon cleric, then it was probably terrible for you. If you lived in the north of England and some areas like the Fens, for instance, where William Conqueror really went to town on them because they weren't doing what he wanted, then obviously it was terrible. I would hazard a guess that for the average individual, my ancestors, I would imagine they think it's pretty much the same as it was before. There's some guy with all the money and a big sword who's telling me to work hard and give him most of the stuff that I produce. So, and I think that's been the story for people of my family's background for as long as you can remember.
But the Doomsday Book was something quite big, wasn't it? It was quite different. And I know there were riots and stuff. When we talk about 1066, the Doomsday Book 1086. This is really, people didn't like the idea that the central government, the king, was getting right into exactly what they were doing. And I suppose documenting everything that they were producing to make sure that they could be very efficiently taxed.
I think the people who were upset were almost certainly the people that owned the land.
The tax dodgers.
Yeah. To a certain extent. I mean, in a way, what the Domesday Book was about cataloguing what people had.
Yeah. An inventory, really.
An inventory of everything. And you know, from a historian's point of view, it's brilliant because you go down and you get... And we mentioned earlier about the Dark Ages. Often the reason why people talk about the Dark Ages is because the Doomsday Book came along later. But it wasn't the first such attempt to make a catalogue of what people had. The church had been doing it in terms of getting tithings for quite a while. It's just, it wasn't as well documented, and it wasn't in... Well, the Doomsday Book is actually two books. There was the one for Norfolk, Suffolk and Essex, the eastern counties, which were the richest parts of the country, had a separate book. And then most of the rest of the country, like Somerset and Gloucestershire, were in the other book. And also, don't forget, there was parts of England that weren't part of England at the time, so they didn't get included.
Now, I've also heard that the Normans were actually over here before the Norman invasion, in an Anglo-Saxon period, the very late Anglo-Saxon period, supposedly helping the Anglo-Saxons with defences against the Welsh and all this sort of thing. So do you think that there was, to a certain extent, the Normans were looking around thinking, gosh, this is a nice place, whilst they were supposed to be helping the Anglo-Saxon rulers?
Well, don't forget the Normans themselves were descendants of Vikings that had settled in northern France in the deal they did with the French king, hence the name Normandy. There were also, Normans were in... England long, Edward the Confessor, for instance, had probably more Normans in his court and in important places than any previous Anglo-Saxon king. And also, we tend to look back of it as the Normans were the enemy, and were the Anglo-Saxons fighting to keep our country free. But there was quite a lot of Anglo-Saxons weren't really supportive of Howard Godwinson, who was the last Anglo-Saxon king of England.
So the thing is, when the Normans turned up, that's when supposedly, anyway, the medieval period starts pretty much. What was the big difference? I mean, you've said for a lot of ordinary people it might have been no difference, but there must have been some kind of line.
There were differences in terms of it was, in a lot of instances, historical rights were starting to be taken away. Almost the entire religious governance was replaced by Normans. Obviously, the big difference was French now became the dominant language in everywhere where people were making decisions. I mean, 1066 is an important date, and probably of all those dates that are just chosen to separate a period of time, then it does make sense for the Norman period rather than the medieval period to be dated from 1066. But there were also changes that came along in the 13th century, which is where we normally tend to think of the medieval period as starting, where England actually expanded and had massive growth and continued to grow and become, you know, a very wealthy country. And the Norman period is sort of like, in a way, sets that up, because they do make changes. Not all those changes are popular. But the Normans were, you know, a force of nature to a certain extent, because it wasn't only England. They also conquered Sicily. They were heavily involved in, obviously later on they started Ireland. They were fighting elsewhere in France. And they were still Vikings. They wanted to go over and conquer them.
Well, they started a sort of big ecclesiastical building program with things like abbeys, cathedrals after the Norman invasion. Well, not straight away after, but also castles as well, because I think people don't necessarily realise we didn't really have that sort of, you know, those big, big stone-built defences up until the Normans.
I would say the one key difference between, because we were talking earlier about Saxon burghs, which was the Saxon equivalent of a castle, if you like. And you compare that to the Norman castle, and what somebody described it, I thought quite well to me, was that the idea of a Saxon burgh was it was there to defend a town against foreign invasion, whereas often the idea of a Norman castle was to dominate the town. So it was kind of reversed, where the Saxon burgh was there to protect you, the Norman castle was there to oppress you.
Fascinating. Anyway, Tony Dyer, author of Anglo-Saxon Democracy, published in 2010. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Since, Suzhou police took over the case from November last year, they did not take action. You see, I filed a complaint to their, superior bosses in Jiangsu province, okay, the governor of the Jiangsu police department, but they did not take action either. You see, until early March this year, okay, I received a call from Suzhou police. On the 4th of March, they invited me to come over and discuss the details of the case. I went on the 5th of March and I spent the day discussing the details, of the case and talked to the policemen because they know nothing about the airspace. And so I told them how to, investigate, how to check with the witnesses and how to look at the criminal facts. I give them all these evidences and for them to investigate. But bad thing happened. On the 10th of March, there came a second Ethiopian MAX crash. 3 days later, on the 13th of March, my house was broken in, okay, intruded in the early morning of the day, 3 o'clock. And you see the security guard rang my doorbell, and I woke up and from three floor, and I talked to the security guard. I said, "Why are you ringing?" He said, "You know, your doors, front doors, why did they open?" I came down and I saw both my doors, bank door and front door, why did they open? Nothing lost. I filed a case with the Shanghai police, and the police came over and checked. You see, that is an official record. I believe this is a warning by the criminals. Suspect, they tried to warn me to stop. But you see, interestingly, NHJ did not know my home address. Only police, they record my address, because I have two living addresses in Shanghai. This one was not known to anybody else except the police. But I am not saying this is, I don't know who broke in my house the day of 13th of March, but this is the fact.
How does that make you feel? How does it affect you, your resolution to pursue this case?
Funny, you know, my life was already compromised since, 2016. Morgue, management intentionally or knowingly released my whistleblowing to NHJ from that 3 years ago. Okay, so my life was completely compromised already. So what fear do I have to fear? I'm not afraid of NHJ. These criminals, I'm afraid, the protection umbrellas, because this is really a send, a fear into, me. But what choice do I have? I have to continue to move on.
Also, Boeing have announced, well, actually, it's not Boeing, it's the financial newspapers have announced that they are taking an $8 billion hit now, and every week it seems to increase because of the grounding of the Boeing 737 MAX 8 aircraft after the two crashes. And I wonder whether you think a Boeing aircraft is a safe aircraft to fly on. Because it's funny, 2 years ago we were discussing this subject, and then after the second crash, we found Boeing didn't want to ground their aircraft, and they were forced to ground the aircraft by the British, then afterwards by the Europeans, and most importantly by the passengers who refused to get on the Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. So how safe is a Boeing to fly on, Charles?
Me, I wish I would never fly this Boeing 737 again.
Charles Shi there, who used to order parts in the production run for a company called Moog, which supplies aircrafts to Boeing and to people who are repairing the Boeing 737s, including the 737 MAX, which has now grounded after crashing. The company apparently using fake parts manufactured by a firm called NHJ, who Charles says are part of the mafia, and Chinese police are failing to investigate the case. We're speaking to Charles Shi there from Shanghai, China, and how ironic, we were speaking to him 2 years ago about Boeing 737 spares being dangerous and fake, and now the most recent version of that aircraft, the 737 MAX, is grounded for indefinite period after two crashes. So well done, Charles Shi, for at least flagging up issues about safety and Boeing paying no attention to them. Don't get on one of those planes ever, is my advice. So we'll put a link up to the full interview with Charles Shi, his whole story, at our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And it's Charles Shi, Shi. Sounds a bit like President Shi, doesn't he? But it's not spelt the same, Shi for Shi. That's all for this week. Dialects, Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. Download it to listen on your phone or in the car or anywhere else. Suggest interviews, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. So thanks to our guests. That's Charles Shi and Tony Dyer, the author of Anglo-Saxon Democracy, published in 2010, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain at the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Deep inside, frightened of this thing that I've become.